From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Former Donald Trump advisor Roger Stone says he believes his arrest this morning was politically motivated, and he's vowing to plead not guilty and fight the charges. Roger Stone was bailed out this morning after being arrested on charges he made false statements to the House Intelligence Committee. We'll have the latest detail and hear from Stone coming up after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is February 18th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to be with you today. Hope you're doing well and have a nice weekend planned. My thanks to Libby Dankman for hosting in my absence yesterday. I'll also be out Monday to attend a family funeral, but good to be with you today in the interim. Coming up in our second hour, Film Week, of course, our critics review the new Matthew McConaughey Anne Hathaway starring film Serenity, a mystery thriller from writer-director Stephen Knight. But we begin with what was the top of the NPR news that you just heard. The arrest early this morning of former Trump advisor Roger Stone. And he was then released on $250,000 bail. Here's what Roger Stone had to say as you hear people chanting in the background.
I find it disturbing that the special counsel's office released a press release prior to informing my attorneys that I would be charged today. This morning, at the crack of dawn, 29 FBI agents arrived at my home with 17 vehicles with their lights flashing when they could simply have contacted my attorneys, and I would have been more than willing to surrender voluntarily. They terrorized my wife, my dogs. I was taken to the FBI facility, although I must say the FBI agents were extraordinarily courteous. I will plead not guilty to these charges. I will defeat them in court. I believe this is a politically motivated investigation. I am troubled by the political motivations of the prosecutors. And as I have said previously, there is no circumstance whatsoever under which I will bear false witness against the president, nor will I make up lies to ease the pressure on myself. I look forward to being fully and completely vindicated.
Extraordinary to me that Stone's attorney allowed him to speak, and then he took a couple of reporters' questions afterwards after being released on bail. But we'll hear a little bit later from legal expert Lori Levinson, Loyola Law School professor, who'll give us her thoughts on that. And then, as you just heard, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, White House press secretary, answered a reporter's question early this morning about the arrest and indictment of Roger Stone.
This doesn't have anything to do with the president, doesn't have anything to do with the White House. One question that I would be interested to see is if these same standards apply, the charges that have been brought are about false testimony, if those same standards will be applied to people who we know have given false testimony in the same matter, like Comey and Clapper and Clinton and others that are in a similar position. I'd be interested to see how that plays out.
All right, with us to talk about this morning's developments, Los Angeles Times reporter Chris McGarry. And Chris, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
So just give us a bit of the timeline on what's central to these allegations. The events that this testimony to Congress was about, this goes back, what, to the summer of 2016?
Yes. So according to the indictment, in the summer of 2016, when WikiLeaks released its first emails, a member of Donald Trump's campaign reached out to Roger Stone to try to learn more about what else WikiLeaks might have and what else WikiLeaks might release. the crux of the crimes is that Roger Stone later lied about this when he was testifying before Congress and urged one of his associates to also lie.
All right. And this was a grand jury indictment, is that right? So members of Mueller's team took this to a grand jury?
Yes. And the indictment was handed up yesterday, and it was sealed until today after he was arrested at his home in Florida.
And is there further allegation that Stone was directly in contact with WikiLeaks, not just with a member of the Trump administration?
It's portrayed in this indictment as if Roger Stone was communicating with WikiLeaks through an intermediary. It's a little unclear exactly what was said back and forth, but then it is also portrayed that he was also communicating with people within the Trump administration. So there definitely was information allegedly passing back and forth. It's just a little bit unclear exactly what was said when.
And in the language of the indictment, I don't know how much time you've had with it, Chris, but is there anything that would indicate potential presidential knowledge of the interaction between the campaign and Trump over the WikiLeaks release of these Democratic emails?
It doesn't say that the president knew about this. However, at one point, the indictment does say that a high-ranking campaign official was, quote, directed to reach out to Roger Stone. He does not say who did that directing, but generally in a hierarchical organization, there's only so many people who can tell a high-ranking person to do something.
All right. And Chris, before I let you go, just your sense of how this morning's arrest of Stone and the indictment, how this fits into the larger Mueller investigation.
First off, the arrest was interesting because Roger Stone, we believe, is the only person who was not allowed to surrender at the courthouse. The FBI went and arrested him at his home. That's, you know, not the usual move. But as far as the larger picture on the legal issues here, this is one of the clearest portrayals of the Trump campaign being interested in WikiLeaks hacked emails and how they might have gone about trying to get those.
Chris, thanks so much. We appreciate, as always, your updates on the Mueller investigation.
Sure, thank you.
Chris McGarrigan, Los Angeles Times reporter based in D.C., also with us, aforementioned Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson, a former federal prosecutor as well. Professor, good morning. First, the circumstances of the arrest of Roger Stone. Why might FBI agents have done it in that way?
Well, my guess, and that's all it is that there probably were prior communications with Roger Stone or his counsel regarding some type of cooperation and the like, and he wasn't interested. You heard him in his remarks today. When you have an individual like this who has foreign contacts, who has repeatedly not only said that he's not going to cooperate, but you're charging him with lying and lying to Congress and being in contact with other people to put pressure on them to lie, then you have somebody that it's really not likely you're going to allow to self-surrender. So in this situation, it might seem heavy-handed to some people, but I'm sure Mueller looked at all the facts and considered them carefully and said, we don't want to let him get loose.
All right. And Stone, I guess the judge asked him this morning to surrender his passport, and Stone said his passport is out of date, which is interesting because Stone, I think, at least used to be quite the international traveler. So that's kind of interesting. Your thoughts, Lori, about the allegations that are contained here. What sort of evidence would the federal government need to have to show that Stone didn't just make accidental misstatements to the congressional committee, but out and out lied?
Oh, I think that they're likely to have evidence that they got from surveillance of telephones. In other words, wiretaps, they may have that information. They certainly have emails that they've been able to hunt down, and they may be having other cooperating witnesses. When you put that together, I do feel that that's the type of evidence that would be sufficient to prove the case.
Lori Levinson, Loyola Law professor with us. And then the question would be, if there's actually evidence out there that would tie it, what would Stone's strategy be for lying to Congress if he had a sense that there would be some sort of documentation of these contacts that would come back to get him for perjuring himself?
You know, I wonder how many of these individuals who have been charged have underestimated what the Mueller team had, because not only might they have had domestic wiretaps, they could have had the FISA wiretaps from the Foreign Intelligence Court. And I think that he was just sort of taking the risk that he could get up there and say what he wanted and that Mueller would not have access to the information. Or, and this hasn't been mentioned yet during your broadcast, but he might be saying, well, why not just deny it? In the end, I bet I get that pardon that others have asked for.
All right. Lori Levinson, Loyola Law School professor. So contained in this indictment is the allegation that a member of the Trump campaign was in contact with Roger Stone about the timing of the WikiLeaks disclosures of the Democratic National Committee emails. Is that illegal for a member of the Trump campaign to be in communication about the release of these illegally hacked emails?
And there the answer, we don't know yet. It depends. It is certainly illegal to lie. It is certainly illegal to tell other people to lie. But what we see is that they're inching closer to who was responsible for the leaks that WikiLeaks got. And the question of whether that was the Russians who did it and whether people in the campaign knew about it, that could fit into a broader charge that indeed it was illegal.
And if someone or individuals within the campaign had knowledge that Russian-backed hackers had obtained this information, are they under any legal obligation to disclose that to law enforcement?
Not necessarily to disclose, but certainly not to encourage or to further it or make themselves available as an opportunity for why they were doing that. So the issue here is, you know, what did they know? You don't have to run around and report people. But if they're doing it for you, then you are assisting, aiding, abetting, facilitating the criminal activity.
And then what would you have doing it for you? What would that have to prove, that you offered some inducement for them to do it on your behalf? Or just if you were talking with them about the timing of it, is that potentially criminal?
If it crossed the line from, gee, you know, this has happened to, I'm encouraging you to do it. It doesn't take much for a conspiracy. It doesn't take much for accomplice liability if it really is your purpose for a criminal activity to happen.
And I would guess, though, that the challenge there for the government is they would actually need to have something like that on a wiretap, on a recording, to prove that that was actually, there was intent behind that, right?
Well, if we're going to the next step, and what you've seen in a case like this, we have historically seen in other matters, whether it be in Watergate or Iran-Contra or the like, that the cover-up tends to be a lot easier to prove than any underlying crimes.
Professor Levinson, as always, thank you so much. Have a good weekend. We appreciate it.
You too. Take care.
Thank you. Loyola Law School Professor Lori Levinson joining us. We just have word that President Trump is scheduled to speak from the Rose Garden of the White House about the partial government shutdown. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders tweeting that the president will make remarks about the potential end to the government shutdown. We'll be back in just 1 minute. We'll hear the president speak. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We are monitoring the White House when the president comes out to speak. We will bring that to you right here on 89.3 KPCC. Well, Governor Gavin Newsom announced earlier this morning that for the first time, California is suing one of its cities over failing to be responsive in allowing additional housing to be built to meet growing population. The governor had talked about this in his lengthy budget address recently, saying that they were going to be doing what they could to encourage cities to be building more housing, but they would in fact be looking to sue cities if they were obstructionist over housing. With us, Los Angeles Times reporter Liam Dillon, who covers both housing and state politics. Good morning, Liam.
Good morning.
So the governor had telegraphed this a bit. I certainly didn't know Huntington Beach was coming as the city, but is there some bad blood or history here between the state and Huntington Beach over housing starts?
Right. So I think this goes back, a while now. So just a little bit of context, every city in the state is required to put together a plan that allows for enough land zoned to accommodate both low income and sort of general population growth over a period of time. And so Huntington Beach did that. Their plan was compliant with state rules on that. But then 3 years ago, they decided to downzone or make certain areas of the city less available for housing. And that then put the city out of compliance with the state law. And from there, there's been going back and forth between the state and the city over the past, since 2015. And we're sort of here where we are today, where the state is apparently saying enough.
And we have a sense at this point, I know this has just happened, but of where Huntington Beach is going to go with this, because obviously they're going to defend themselves on this. But is there any talk of a way that the city could comply and avoid the repercussions of the suit?
Sure. So I haven't been unable so far this morning to reach Huntington Beach officials specifically. But during the past, since 2015, since they took the action to downzone certain parts of their community, there's been a lot of discussion about alternatives, right? And so the idea is, even if a certain area you say, well, we don't want affordable housing there anymore, or we don't want a plan for there anymore, the state law says you have to find other places where you will accommodate it. There have been various plans that have been floated, but the city council has not passed any of them.
And in the Pleasanton case, which you've written about, this morning, did that Northern California city fully capitulate to the state on the dispute there over its caps on housing construction?
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. That was 2009. It was a little before my time in terms of covering this issue. But in terms of what I've read about it, the state was going after a cap on the number of homes that were allowed in the community that Pleasanton had. The result of that lawsuit was Pleasanton got rid of its cap. They zoned more land in the city for housing, and they ended up paying a lot of money, about $4 million in attorney fees, once it was all said and done.
And share with us Huntington Beach and the specific action that's involved here, because as you write, back in 2015, there were zoning codes that limited construction. And have, to your knowledge, been any other challenges to this in the intervening 3 years plus?
With respect to Huntington?
To that cap, yeah, to that zoning change they did in 15.
Right. So there's this kind of pretty wonky lawsuit that was filed against Huntington Beach by a local affordable housing activist over that particular action, basically saying they were not allowed to do what they did. Huntington Beach ended up winning that lawsuit at the appellate court because they're one of a handful of cities in the state that have their own special rules. They're known what's called as a charter city, so they're allowed to have more lenient land use policies than cities that are not charter cities. So they won that case. There was then subsequent state legislation that said, look, we're in the future, charter city or whatever other kind of city you are, doesn't matter, all these state laws are going to apply. And so I think there's been a lot of attention on this city as, in some cases, a poster child for, doing things that are out of line with what the state is hoping to have in terms of having every city plan for, a sufficient amount of affordable housing.
We're talking with Los Angeles Times reporter Liam Dillon, who has written about the lawsuit filed by the Newsom administration against the city of Huntington Beach on the city's caps on additional housing. Back in 2015, as Liam quotes in his story, there were people in Huntington Beach said, look, we don't want to change the character of our city. We don't want to see a bunch of construction that's going to have an effect on traffic and quality of life. We're concerned about doing that. So now you've got the city in direct conflict with the state of California and the law requiring that cities keep up with population growth. But Liam, I assume it's more the norm than not that California cities have not kept up with population growth. That, at least in urban areas, that's pretty much the norm, right?
Yeah. So this law is long been sort of a it's difficult, right? Because, you know, in a lot of ways, this makes sense. It's not like cities and counties are out there building houses themselves, right? They, you know, that's what developers do. And so it's not, again, cities and counties don't have absolute control over what goes on in their communities. That being said, there are a lot of policies that that cities can put into place, whether it's restrictive zoning, whether it's high fees, whether it's, you know, a large requirements for a lot of parking for every new development, that can block development that would otherwise occur. And so this state law is basically out there to say, you know, you as a city have to have, as a minimum, strip away some of these restrictions to allow for what we expect the population growth in your community to be. Right. And so there are, you know, I'd say, you know, the vast majority of cities in the state have at least complied with these planning requirements that the state has. Huntington Beach is one of a few that does not. And I think even more so, there are even less cities that had passed plans that did comply and then gone back and said, well, wait a second, actually, we want to take some of that away, and then dropped out of compliance. So I think the targeting of Huntington Beach here is in a particular case to say, you know, the state saying this may be one of kind of the worst of the worst cities when it comes to not complying with this law.
Liam, thanks so much. Really appreciate your sharing with us this very new story with the Newsom administration announcing the filing of the lawsuit earlier this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Liam Dillon joining us from the Los Angeles Times. He covers housing and state politics. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Once again, we are awaiting President Trump's statements from the Rose Garden of the White House, in which he's expected to announce some sort of development about the partial government shutdown, which is historically long. We don't have any details on that. And if Democratic leaders have agreed to terms of something, but again, just as soon as the president comes out of the Rose Garden, we will bring that to you if anticipated in the next few minutes. But we turn our attention now to recently published a study by the U.S. Army War College of the U.S. war in Iraq. It's a two-volume report comprised of more than 1,300 pages, includes more than 3,000 declassified documents, which studies the eight-year-long war. It's the costliest conflict since the Vietnam War, and of course, highly controversial decisions and strategies that were made by the U.S. military. With us, former Special Forces officer and co-editor, one of the principal authors of the Army War College study, retired Colonel Frank Sopcich. Colonel, thank you so much for being with us to talk about the report.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the conclusion is that there were numerous mistakes here, and that Iran ended up as essentially the big winner out of the Iraq war. Let's start, first of all, with that. In what ways was Iran benefited?
So Iran was able to access routes through Iraq to try to build kind of a Shia crescent. Strategically, Iraq had been kind of a bulwark to Iranian expansionism. And that was one of the reasons why the coalition forces decided not to go to Baghdad during the first Gulf War, during Operation Desert Storm in 1991. With that kind of bulwark removed, it enabled Iranian expansionism and adventurism. And while, you know, Iran does not control Iraq, you know, puppet master-wise, it certainly has significant influence within the country, as well as it's been enabled to act within Yemen, Lebanon, and Syria.
One of the most controversial decisions at the time was the disbanding of Iraq's military forces. And what was the report's conclusion about that?
Yeah, our conclusion was that that was one of the fundamental mistakes of the early phase of the war. And that it kind of is the conventional wisdom. And we agree with the conventional wisdom. We think that is a justified conclusion. It effectively put, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of trained, armed people into the arms of the insurgency and gave them a reason to join the insurgency.
And was that decision at the time made based on previous U.S. Or other nations' military experience where they didn't disband the previous military and found that created problems?
So it was hard as a historian to nail down precisely where and why the decision was made, because the level that we were studied at and that we were given primarily access to is the operational level of war, which is the level of war that translates political decisions into military guidance. And as such, we didn't, you know, have access to White House and National Security Council records. We did have access to records at Central Command.
I'm so sorry I have to interrupt. I believe the president, he hasn't quite come out. I'm so sorry to interrupt you in mid-sentence. Please pick right up.
I understand 100%. We did not have access to the political decision-making records. So our assessment was that we did have access to leaders at the Defense Department, senior leaders. Secretary Rumsfeld was only one of three individuals who declined an interview. However, we were able to interview the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, as well as Secretary Feith. And our conclusion was that decision was made ideologically, with the concept that the Ba'ath Party and its army had parallels to the Nazis in World War II, and that you had to kind of expunge them completely from Iraq, and that ideological perspective drove that decision.
When you conducted these interviews with folks like former President Bush and Condoleezza Rice, Leon Panetta, Robert Gates, and all, was there sort of a consistent theme that you heard from them in terms of regrets, or was their analysis widely varying?
Their analysis really varied wildly, and you know, different individuals, I would say, had more regret than others. I will tell you that, particularly within the military, it is the war hits home the most. You know, you lose soldiers, your men and women of your units. And as we were doing interviews, I had one 4-star general and one 3-star general cry during the interviews over just memories of individuals that they lost. So it really depends on the individual.
We're talking with retired Colonel Frank Sopcich, a former Special Forces officer. He's co-editor and one of the principal authors of this voluminous Army War College study looking at the U.S. Army in the Iraq War. It's a 2-volume study, including more than 3,000 declassified documents, multiple interviews with individuals who were at the center of decision-making during the course of the Iraq War's 8 years. Years, more than 1,300 pages. Colonel, how is a study like this typically used? And is there something comparable to this that came out of the Vietnam War?
So the best, you know, initial comparison would be World War II. And there was a series of books at the end of the war that were done to kind of assess what happened, why the decisions were made, and what consequences occurred. There is a study that is still ongoing on the Vietnam War to take lessons from that. Unfortunately, it is not concluded, and the Center of Military History is still working on it. That was one of the reasons that our project was stood up, was to be able to put together conclusions on a much shorter time basis so that they would be accessible to civilian and military decision makers.
Colonel, so there are a number of decisions that ended up with unintended negative consequences here. Are there clear conclusions that you and your co-authors are able to make about what would have been better strategies, or is it difficult to make those contentions as opposed to concluding what went wrong?
In general, you know, there are some general conclusions that I think that things could have gone much differently if they had been applied. one of the maxims of war that was ignored at various times throughout the conflict was the strategic premise of balancing ends, ways, and means, with ends being your objective, ways being the style of tactics or strategy that you're going to use to accomplish that, and means being the resources, both in terms of manpower, units, dollars, reconstruction funds, et cetera, that are going to be used to accomplish that. At various times of the conflict, those were out of balance. And if they had been rebalanced appropriately at several times in the conflict, we believe that things could have gone differently.
And who's ultimately responsible? Is that the job of the president, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs? Or does this just have to be a collaborative process? No single person is in that position.
So, I mean, you know, I think you go back to the statement of President Truman, the buck stops here. So ultimately, you know, the president is responsible for decisions that are made. However, in reality, the decisions are very much a collaborative process. And those decisions are made by civilian elected officials, civilian nominated officials, as well as military officials providing their best military advice. So in reality, responsibility to a degree is shared. And for certain, the military, our role, this study focused on the military, because that's really our role within proper civil-military relations, is to assess the mistakes that we made. And we certainly made our share of them that led to the ultimate outcome.
Colonel, I thank you so much for talking about this remarkable study, so many years in the making, and all the documents and interviews that you and your team were immersed with in putting this together. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Retired Colonel Frank Sopcich joining us. U.S. Army War College study, 2 volumes, 1,300 pages looking back at the Iraq War, decisions that were made, and the consequences. President Trump scheduled to come out momentarily to talk about the historic and length partial government shutdown, but first a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Coming up in just a few minutes on Film Week, all the week's new movies, including Serenity, film starring Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway, Stephen Knight, the writer-director. That not to be confused with Joss Whedon's sci-fi film Serenity of a few years ago. Same title, totally different film. We'll hear what our critics have to say about it. And we'll also look at 2 of the Oscar categories that will not be a part of our annual Film Week Academy Awards preview at the Theater at Ace Hotel, Best Foreign Language Film and Best Cinematography. We'll take a look at those 2 categories coming up on Film Week next hour here on 89.3 KPCC. Once again, we are monitoring the White House. As soon as President Trump comes out to the Rose Garden, where he is expected to make some sort of an announcement regarding the historic partial government shutdown, we will be bringing you the president live just as soon as that happens. But yesterday, there was an announcement made at the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland, that a number of American companies are going to be providing their products in reusable containers that will be able to be cleaned out, returned, and used yet again. The companies who are making their products available in recycling containers include Nestle, Unilever, Procter & Gamble, PepsiCo, some of the very biggest. Joining us to talk about the project, the pilot, which is dubbed Loop, is the founder and CEO of TerraCycle. It's a recycling firm. They are heading up this project, Loop, with these private companies. Tom Zaki, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So share with us how the consumer's going to be experiencing this. Will you be buying essentially the same product off the shelf, like, say, a deodorant container, but then you end up returning it once you're done with it?
It's a great question. So the pivotal shift in Loop is about changing ownership. You know, today when we go and we buy our favorite products at our favorite store, we buy the product, but we also end up buying the package. And our theory here is that, you know, people don't really want to own these packages the moment they're empty, and it creates the entire waste problem we experience today. With Loop, the ownership of the package shifts to the manufacturer. So P&G retains ownership of its products from Tide to Pantene packages. And this shift in ownership allows the packages to not only be durable, which makes them reusable versus just recyclable or disposable, but also beautifully designed with wonderful materials and even potentially new features. And then as a consumer, you experience it exactly the same way at your favorite retailer with your favorite brands. If you shop online, the products are delivered to you. And then once they're empty, dirty, no cleaning, they're picked up from you and go to reuse. And if you shop in store, you would be able to buy them in store and then return them to the store or other methods that will develop for pickup.
So this is a pilot program to see if consumers really go to that trouble of returning an empty deodorant container or, as you said, Pantene bottle, or if they're willing to put it in a box to have it shipped back. Has this been tried elsewhere to see if this would work, other countries, for example?
Well, Loop has been 2 years in development. So it's gone quite quickly, and we've been doing quite a lot of consumer insights in the United States and in Europe, both with live consumers as well as many other forms of consumer insights. And it really shows that, you know, people are ready for this. People seem to be a little fed up with single use disposability, and I think we're seeing this in legislation on the plastic straw and general public concern. Loop will be going live in a few months' time in the northeast of the United States, servicing New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, and then in parallel in Paris, in the suburbs of Paris, and then a few months after that in London. Those will be the three key regions of the world where it's tested. And then pending that success, it'll go into quite an aggressive scale-out. Folks can, of course, learn more at loopstore.com if they'd like to see what all this looks like.
Wouldn't it be more efficient to just have people who are already used to recycling to put this in their recycling, and then you'd have the recycler would be the ones to sort it and send it back in bulk to the manufacturer?
Well, it's a really good point. And I think if the reuse model of Loop can scale, where we're talking meaningful percentages of consumers are now using reusable containers versus recyclable, it could be something that becomes a curbside pickup. Because in the end, the only difference between what we're doing at Loop and what a recycler does is instead of shredding and melting the packaging down into new materials, we're cleaning it and then providing it back to the manufacturer for refill. But while it's at the beginning, the type of distribution methods that we're using are the most pragmatic, of being able to deliver directly to your home and then pick up directly from your home through an e-commerce model. And then from there, of course, we can scale.
How is this going to affect the price? Because if it is a more durable, more beautifully designed package, as you mentioned, and you don't get a particularly high rate of return, that money for that packaging is then lost to the manufacturer. So how do you avoid the price of the product being at a premium as a result of this?
The key here is this shift in ownership. And by the manufacturer owning the package, they retain that cost. Now, the consumer does have to pay a deposit, which is fully returned no matter what condition the package is returned in at the end of its use. And then once that deposit is paid back, the price that the consumer will have paid will be effectively the same as what they would have paid for the disposable alternative.
We're talking with Tom Zaki, who's the founder and CEO of TerraCycle, New Jersey-based recycling firm and the parent company of Loop, the pilot program that's handling the delivery, returns, and cleaning for a number of major consumer product companies that are looking at piloting, making those products available in returnable, reusable containers. We're going to come back and talk with the head of the Container Recycling Institute, Susan Collins, get her thoughts about this. And also Golden Gate University professor Kit Yarrow will talk with us about how consumers might relate to this. We're talking about Loop and what the potential is for people to go to the consistent trouble of recycling for the reuse of their consumer product containers. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle again. When President Trump speaks about the partial government shutdown, we'll bring that to you live here on KPCC. Right now, our focus is on Loop, a pilot program in several large cities to find out whether consumers are going to embrace the idea of more durable, reusable containers for popular consumer goods, for which they would pay a deposit. They would return the containers once they've used the product, and then they would have the deposit refunded. With us, Susan Collins, head of the Container Recycling Institute, which is a nonprofit, follows the recycling industry and trends. Ms. Collins, thank you for joining us. Your thoughts about the viability of this?
Good morning, Larry. I'm very interested in hearing about this program and that the fact that it has chosen to use some of the most powerful incentives and most greenhouse gas reducing concepts. However, I think while there are some excellent features of this program, those features may be misapplied in this case. Two features that I want to mention are deposits and refillables and talk about those. First of all, putting a deposit on a container, deposits are an incredibly powerful incentive for recycling or reuse. In fact, they are the most powerful incentive we have ever seen. And if they're properly implemented, we can see recovery rates above 90%. And we do see that in several countries throughout the world for beverage containers. But in this case, the deposit would be applied on a voluntary basis, not a mandatory basis, and to a niche group of products and a niche group of consumers. So I don't think it's going to have the widespread impact that we see with deposit containers. Refillables are also wonderful, and I think the world is moving in that direction eventually. They reduce energy use and reduce greenhouse gases for packaging, and they can cut those numbers in half.
Do you think this would work if it were scaled so that people wouldn't have to deal, you know, you take this back themselves to a supermarket or a drugstore, but could instead just throw it in their recycling and the recycling center deals with it?
I don't see how you could put it in the typical recycling system without incredible damage to the containers. The way refillables are typically handled, they don't get crushed. And they get handled in a separate way. Also, there is usually for refillables, there's tremendous uniformity in the design of the packaging. So you're only using one common container across many brands, and you're doing it across a volume of literally billions of containers. And the washing systems are washing tens of thousands of containers every hour. So again, this proposal doesn't, you know, meet those standards that would drive those huge efficiencies and huge quantities of materials being recycled or recovered.
Susan Collins of the Container Recycling Institute. She's the head of that organization. Also with us from Golden Gate University in San Francisco, professor and consumer research psychologist Kit Yarrow. Professor, thank you for joining us again. We appreciate it. What do you think are the potential hurdles behaviorally here?
Well, first of all, Larry, I think consumers are going to love this idea. Obviously, as slightly more affluent consumers, it does take a initial investment. But not only did they get to have, a more premium product for the most part, but they also get to feel good about themselves. So it's kind of feels like a win-win to them. The stature of the brand is elevated somewhat by this more permanent-looking, more, you know, beautiful package that they're in. It's kind of like an interesting and new concept that will attract consumers. These are the pros. To answer your question, consumer decision-making is a very complex matrix. And consumers have to navigate through a number of different factors. The two biggest ones have the potential to kill this. One is any additional hassle, any inconvenience, or any added expense, a lot of times can kill the deal for consumers. It doesn't sound to me like, given the marketplace that they're attracting, that'll be a deal buster for this product. I actually think it'll be successful, but it is certainly a concern.
All right. We're talking with Golden Gate University Professor Kit Yarrow with us on Air Talk. Tom Zaki of TerraCycle in the pilot program Loop here. Are the consumers in these markets where this is being piloted going to have two different packaged versions of a product, let's say a shampoo? One is in the customary disposable packaging. The other is in this more glamorized, reusable packaging, and they'll be side by side? Or how is that going to work?
Absolutely. So with the brands that we're working with, which are most of the major large producers, their products will be available in both formats, in the current, let's say, classic disposable, but also not all, but a large range of products will be available in the durable alternatives, not just from these producers, but also private label products from the retailers and so on. Now, they likely will not be at the same spot on the shelf, the way, for example, Carrefour in France and Tesco in the UK, these are large retailers there, will be deploying it. It's stacking them all together in what they would call a package-free aisle. This way, if consumers want to live their life in, let's say, durability and not disposability, they can have all the products in one place. Very similar to how, I would say, organic products would be distributed
in supermarkets. Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds just like organic produce.
That's exactly right, yes. And so at the moment, you know, the key will be offering these two choices. But then as durable takes off, and I hope it will, then we may see a replacement of disposable with durable and really to the proportion of consumers' interest.
Kit Yarrow, Golden Gate University, do you think that makes sense to do this as a totally specific display where all these products, regardless of what type of product, are together? Kit?
Yes, absolutely. So it definitely makes the entire process seem part of the emotional experience for the consumer and a more integrated program and something where they emotionally connect to this new behavior that they're embracing.
And let me go back to Susan Collins, Container Recycling Institute. You mentioned about how the deposit experience has, I think you said, upwards of 90% redemption, that that's a strong incentive here. So what do you think are some of the areas where they're probably going to have to work out the kinks?
Well, again, the deposit, we were talking about the different personality types and the motivations of different types of consumers. The deposit is great because it cuts across all those different types. So you can be a person who is a virtuous green person who wants to recycle all the time and you'll go the extra mile, go out of your way to do that. Or you can be a person who's a total curmudgeon about recycling, but you still want your dime back. And that's why the deposit programs are so great, that deposit is an incentive that cuts across all different personality types. So in the state of Michigan, their deposit law has a recovery rate of 92%. And in Oregon, they have a recovery rate of 90%. And that's due to the 10-cent deposit on the beverage containers in those states.
And a lot of this, I know, is just individuals who go out and do their own collecting. It's not necessarily the same consumer that bought the bottle who takes it back. Real quickly, is it possible that that could be what happens, sort of secondary industry develops here?
It can. It depends on the amount of the deposit. So in Germany, where the deposit is 25 euro cents, everybody takes back their own containers.
All right. I want to thank you for being with us. That's Susan Collins of the Container Recycling Institute, Kit Yarrow, Golden Gate University, and Tom Zaki of Loop, this pilot program that's being tried in a number of different markets around the world to see whether people will pay a premium for more durable, recyclable packaging that actually goes back to the manufacturer, is refilled and reused for the very same purpose. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC Film Week, as well as President Trump's statement coming out soon.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA, with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor and Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast. We begin with Serenity, a dramatic thriller written and directed by Stephen Knight. It stars Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway. It tells the story of a fishing boat captain with a mysterious past, which, of course, comes back to haunt him when his ex-wife turns up and asks him to save her and their son from a violent new husband.
My husband is joining me here the day after tomorrow. I told him that I would charter a boat for fishing tuna. I want you to take him out on your boat. Let him get drunk. Then drop him in the ocean for the sharks. In return, I will give you $10 million cash.
Serenity, what'd you think, Christy?
I'm so happy I get to describe this movie and talk about it today with you guys. I'm going to try really hard to describe it and not spoil its many massive plot twists and its many delights that are in store for you. This movie is nuts. It is insane. It is terrible, but it must be experienced. It is so fun. And it reminds me of movies like The Book of Henry and Collateral Beauty that are so insane with these incredible casts that are totally overqualified for this stuff, and you wonder, what are they doing here? Starting with Matthew McConaughey. He plays this fishing boat captain who is damaged and chain smoking and hard drinking, and he's an Iraq war veteran living on this remote, idyllic island. He wants to hide. He wants the quiet of this place. And Anne Hathaway is the ultimate film noir femme fatale, comes sauntering in through the door of the only bar on the entire island, the mysterious island of Plymouth. And she gives him this proposition, as we just heard. Jason Clarke is the horribly abusive husband. Everybody in this is a total film noir type. They're all the arch cliches. The music, as we heard in that clip, is really melodramatic. It's totally nuts. And then Stephen Knight, who wrote and directed Locke, which was an excellent piece of kind of narrative trickery, kind of yanks the rug out from us halfway through. And then yanks the entire thing at the end and kind of waves a rug around in the air like, ha-ha, see, this rug used to be underneath your feet and now it's not. And the twists are not nearly as profound as he seems to think.
What you think, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of, like, really crazy, nutty movies. Yeah. I don't know if I would say it's a good movie. It's sort of intriguingly bad. Matthew McConaughey has sort of become, like, sort of, you know, A-list Nick Cage in making these kind of bizarre movies where he's, you know, you're not quite sure what he's up to. The role he plays here, you know, he's searching for this big tuna. It's kind of like he's like a nut brain Ahab trying to land this gigantic tuna that he's named Justice. And you know, a lot of this film, you know those commercials that McConaughey does for Lincoln?
Yes.
Cars?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like
very atmospheric.
Yeah,
commercials.
I mean, it's kind of like it's sort of in that
taking
realm
the
of
ferry to the
right. You know,
location.
It's kind of like head scratching time. But you know, it's worth seeing. I think the cast is pretty terrific. It's beautifully shot. It's not as quite as intriguing as I think they want it to be, and it's more confusing than anything else in the end. But it's definitely something that should be experienced.
Yeah, with friends.
Diverting, yeah. As they say.
Diverting, right.
Serenity is rated R. It's in wide release. Stephen Knight, the writer, director, Matthew McConaughey, and Anne Hathaway star. The Kid Who Would Be King is a family adventure, modern-day spin on the King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table legend. Joe Cornish wrote the screenplay and directs. It stars Louis Ashbourne's Circus as Alex, a young boy who stumbles upon a sword stuck in a block of concrete with a mysterious Latin inscription.
It means Sword of Arthur, son of Tintagel. Who's Tintagel?
It's a place. An island off the coast of Cornwall. Some people say it's where King Arthur was born.
Alex, what if you're the only person who could have pulled that sword out? What if it's the sword in the stone?
The Kid Who Would Be King, Christy?
I like this a lot, and a lot more than I expected that I would at the outset, given that it's January. It's really fun, and it's got kind of a great kid energy about it, but then also real adventures and real dangers and real stakes in a way that reminded me of some films from the 80s like Time Bandits and The Goonies, where kids were in actual trouble and the film does not coddle them or condescend to them. They've got to figure it out for themselves and work together. Louis Ashbourne Circus, son of Andy Circus, is really good in this. He's got a really lovely natural kind of screen presence. I also really very much liked Dean Chamu as his kind of goofy, awkward best friend. It's a good cast. It is the Sword and the Stone legend. But in a modern day setting that feels accessible and feels real, Patrick Stewart and Rebecca Ferguson class up the cast quite a bit. Angus Emery plays the younger version of Merlin, who's kind of the smartest guy in the room, but also really goofy and really impatient. I liked him a lot. If you're thinking about bringing kids, just FYI, there is some potentially scary imagery in here. There are these giant cavalries of flaming skeletons on horseback, full of armor, and they're very menacing. So there is some kind of scary imagery here for very little kids. But I would say if you have kids who are about 8 or 9 and they're knowledgeable about all the Merlin stuff, they might dig it.
And that might help, having a little bit of background,
yes,
going
for sure.
into it.
My son did. Yes, he liked it a lot.
It's rated PG. Peter, what do you think of The Kid Who Would Be King?
Well, not quite as much. I mean, you referenced Time Bandits, Christy. I wish this film had had a kind of, you know, nuttier, visionary, I wish Terry Gilliam, you know, in his prime had sort of stepped in, or more to the point, John Borman, who did Excalibur. But, you know, that's probably asking for too much. I think it's a good conventional film with a little bit too many life lessons piled into it. I mean, it's actually what the Arthurian five things that you need to do to be a better person. That's referenced in the film. But, you know, Andy Serkis's kid is... I think well on his way to becoming the Gollum of the next generation if he wants to be.
Have we seen him in anything else, do you know?
Yeah, he is a voice of one of the characters in this recent live-action or performance-caption film that Andy Serkis directed called Mowgli. A recent take on the Jungle Book.
Yeah.
He's one of the voices of this cute little wolf pup in that. But we should mention also, Joe Cornish wrote and directed this, and he did Attack the Block, which was a really fun kind of mishmash, like modern day sci-fi alien kind of dark comedy, which gave us John Boyega, who is now Finn in the Star Wars movies. And I really like the energy that he brings. It was like a rough-hewn kind of like low-tech energy that he brings to these films. I like very much.
He also co-wrote The Adventures of Tintin for Spielberg.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So Joe Cornish. And so it sounds like, Peter, you sort of like the idea of this, but it wasn't executed.
I just took it as a metaphor for the Brexit crisis, actually.
Oh, maybe.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, no, now that
really,
you mention it,
really?
That's a really good point, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is a British-U.S. co-production now?
I guess so, yeah.
So there's some Brits as well as Americans in the cast.
Oh,
here.
And of course, Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
Is Merlin.
Is Merlin. He wears a Led Zeppelin T-shirt, which is a great
literally,
touch.
Literally?
Yeah.
He literally. It's cute.
The Kid Who Would Be King, Joe Cornish, the writer, director, starring Louis Ashbourne Circus, Patrick Stewart, Rebecca Ferguson. It's rated PG, and you can see it in wide release. King of Thieves, a British drama, stars Michael Caine, Jim Broadbent, and Tom Courtney. James Marsh directs from the screenplay written by Joe Penhall. Peter.
This is based on an actual robbery that I was not aware of in 2015. It was a robbery in London of a safe deposit institution that cash, gold, and jewelry, you know, tons of money were pulled out of it. Not all of it has come back. Carried out by a bunch of old retired codgers. So you see this film and you think it's sort of like one of these over-the-hill gang movies, except the cast is so amazing that what should be sort of, you know, a not very good heist movie that tries to be all things to all people tonally is definitely watchable because, I mean, listen, I mean, this cast, Michael Caine, who's the leader, Jim Broadbent, cast against type as a bad guy, Tom Courtenay, Michael Gambon has this bit role, one of the great actors, yeah. And Ray Winstone. I mean, it's like I kept expecting, you know, Vanessa Redgrave or Glenda Jackson to show up, you know, playing a bank teller. I mean, it's just very bizarre. I guess, you know, you take the work where you get it, but it doesn't really hang together as anything more than a conventional caper movie except for that cast.
Yeah, it's kind of a mishmash of tones, as you say, because it is kind of like the grumpy old men on an adventure movie, and it's also like a one last heist movie, and these are both totally cliched premises that we have seen time and time again. Of course, these guys could just sit around and just have tea and talk, and that would be enormously watchable right there. They make it watchable, and it's kind of wacky for a while. And then it gets really serious when they all begin turning on each other.
Yeah,
and
the dishonor among thieves.
Yeah, theme. It becomes a different kind of movie, like all of a sudden. We should mention James Marsh directed this, who is an Oscar winner for the documentary Man on Wire, which is excellent and a really different kind of film. He also did The Theory of Everything.
By the way, just a very quick note. When I saw Man on Wire in Sundance, Philip Petit was there to introduce it and tripped on his
President
way up to
Trump
the
has come out. We take you to the Rose Garden of the White House. We continue with Film Week. Film critic Peter Rayner talking about King of Thieves, a drama starring Michael Caine, Jim Broadbent, Tom Courtenay, Ray Winstone, extraordinary cast, Michael Gambon as well. The film directed by James Marsh, written by Joe Pennell. Peter, you're just talking about how tremendous ingredients went into this film, if not the end result.
Yeah, I mean, it's like having, you know, all top ingredients for a casserole that kind of doesn't quite taste that appetizing. But it's just a tribute to how wonderful these actors are that you can watch this film anyway and sort of get enough involved in it just through the art of acting. And each of the performers' styles are so different from each other, too. You know, there's sort of Tom Courtenay is kind of very closed in. He's playing a character who's hard of hearing. Michael Caine. You know, Michael Caine is arguably, you know, one of the two or three greatest actors in movies still. I wish he chose better roles, but on the other hand, he said he was going to retire 10 years ago, and he hasn't, so.
Yeah, this is very much a Michael Caine role that we have seen before, but he's so excellent at it. And there's some cool old footage at the end of these actors in previous roles that kind of brings it all full circle.
Oh, that sounds fun. King of Thieves, James Marsh directs, Joe Pennell wrote it. It's rated R. You can see it at the AMC Universal City Walk. The Invisibles, a German biopic starring Maximilian Mauf. Klaus Raefle is the director and co-screenwriter with Alejandra Lopez. Peter, what'd you think of The Invisibles?
Well, it's a fascinating story. There seems to be an endless number of twists on Holocaust narratives, and I hadn't really been too aware of this one, you know, there were 1,700 Berlin Jews who remained in Berlin during the Holocaust, you know, sort of in plain sight. Most of the characters that we see in the film were in safe houses, but they did go out into the streets and so forth. The problem for me with this movie is that it's pretty rocky because it's a docudrama with actors acting out stories that we kept cutting into for either archival footage or voiceover narration, or first-person interviews with the four people who are portrayed in the film, two of whom have since died since the film's been made. So it's kind of like you keep sort of shifting into a different gear, and then you get shifted back again. And the archival stuff and the first-person stuff is so powerful that you know, it's no fault of the film except in the concept itself that the actors and the dramatizations, I think, just can't live up to that.
It's a very ambitious mishmash, and it took me a long time to get into its rhythms because, like you, I would be so engrossed by the actual people telling their stories. There's so much drama, so much pathos in that, and then it would just jerk into a really nicely, handsomely staged recreation of the events that they are speaking of. And it goes back and forth between the documentary interviews and the recreations of those moments. And ultimately, they do kind of complement each other, but it always feels a little awkward and a little jumpy. But the stories themselves are fascinating. The one young woman who you know, dyed her hair blonde and would go to the movies, the same movie over and over again, just to have some place to go during the day. So there are some very vivid details of how they survived. But ultimately, yeah, it's like maybe it would have been better as one thing or the other.
Yeah.
I'm curious your thoughts just generally about docudrama. I mean, that's sort of what I think of as this genre, the combining of that. Because to me, I find one pulls me out of the other. I feel kind of whipsawed usually.
Yeah, well, that's how I felt here. Because, I mean, it's sort of like if, you know, you're watching Shoah and then they keep cutting in with, you know, like dramatizations of what you're watching. There's no way that even routine archival footage and interviews can't be more powerful than the dramatizations given the subject matter itself.
We're talking about The Invisibles, a German biographical docudrama. Klaus Raefle, the director and co-screenwriter. It's unrated at Lemley's Royal in West Los Angeles, Lemley's Town Center in Encino as well. We have more of Film Week coming your way right here on 89.3 KPCC. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, and I sure hope we're going to see you at the Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles for the next Film Week Academy Award preview. We'll have our Film Week critics on stage. We'll watch clips from the Oscar-nominated Best Picture nominees. It's going to be a terrific afternoon, Sunday afternoon, February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotel. Get your tickets now. It's sold out last year. You visit kpcc.org/in-person, and I sure look forward to seeing you then. Our next film was actually released a couple of years ago in France, but the documentary now makes its way to the U.S. Jihadist is the film, which is written and directed by Francois Margolin and Lemin Ould Salim. Peter, what did you think of Jihadist?
Well, it's a powerful movie. It's no great piece of documentary filmmaking, but it's quite revelatory. The filmmaker, particularly Salim, was spent many years following the jihadi occupation of northern Mali, and got to meet with a number of the members of this extreme subset of radical Islam. And films them talking about what they do, and you know it's very hard to watch some of this film because it's quite brutal. You see assassinations and killings and things, you know, on newsreel footage. There's a lot of Salafism propaganda footage that's in the movie too. All of which is quite fascinating and quite scary. The other filmmaker. Margolin has said that, you know, his family, many perished in the Holocaust, and that was one of the reasons why he wanted to make this movie, to understand, you know, what these people are like. And he said, you know, just a brief statement about it, he says, it's important to listen to what these people have to say because they are not crazy and they have not escaped from psychiatric wards. They are not isolated people. They're people with an ideology, hard to listen to, words that have a hard time hearing, images that are hard to look at. But it's important to know today that these people have decided to wage war on us. So, you know, that's sort of his mission that he states up front in the film.
What do you think of it, Christy?
It's not a particularly good film, per se. It's constructed in just the absolute simplest, rawest way. Just, it's a series of talking heads. And in between the talking heads, the director will explain, sitting at his editing bay, you see his, you know, the monitor behind him where he has worked, explaining his thought process in including certain kinds of footage or whatever, why he has, there's ISIS propaganda footage in here, because I guess they couldn't actually get access to the Islamic State, so they include that to have that component of it. I wish it had been put together a little more artfully And again, what they're saying is so powerful. What they're saying is quite shocking. But it grows a little repetitive. It's just like one man after another, sitting on the floor, same kind of backdrop behind them of books or whatever's in their living room. And it's kind of dry. And I just wish that there had been more, I don't know, artfulness or craft in compiling it.
It was originally banned in France because they felt it was too, you know, much sort of advocacy for what was being spoken, as you know, that so they contextualized it for the version that we're seeing with these interviews with the filmmakers that put it more into a perspective, you know, that they're not just showing you this stuff and, you know, you decide for yourself.
The film is unrated, although clearly not for kids, given the subject matter. Highly violent subject matter.
No.
Jihadist is the film, unrated. It's playing one day, next Thursday, at Lemley's Royal Theater, and one day, next Friday, Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Jihadist is the film. The German-U.S. co-production action flick Polar stars Mads Mikkelsen and Vanessa Hudgens. It's directed by Jonas Åkerlund. Jason Rothwell wrote the screenplay. Peter, what did you think of Polar?
Yeah, from Netflix, the company that gave you Roma, we have Mads Mikkelsen as a hired assassin. It's pretty grody to the max, this film. It's ultra violent.
Word I haven't heard in a while.
Well, I'm bringing it back. It's very you know, it's graphic. It's based on a graphic novel, and it's way over the top. You know, in ways that I didn't particularly appreciate. It's funny. I mean, Mikkelsen is playing this you know, great hitman, but he's gone into retirement. But the plot of the film is that he works for a company. There's actually a hitman company that pays pensions. You know, I didn't know that. So, you know,
if you're fortunate enough to reach retirement.
Well, there's the rub, because as you approach 50, you're asked to retire. But the scurvy head of the company, the CEO, decides that he's going to kill off all the assassins before they get to 50 so they don't have to pay out the pension. So Mikkelsen's onto this.
Is that played for comedy or serious?
Well, I think it's hard to tell. I think it's serious, but I was laughing. I guess Liam Neeson was unavailable for this movie, but Mads Mikkelsen, who's also in a film coming up called Arctic.
Arctic next week is Arctic.
Polar and Arctic.
Yeah, and Liam Neeson is shortly going to be in a movie called Cold Pursuit. So I guess there's a chill in the air.
Yeah, and Frozen 2, is that coming? Polar, starring Mads Mikkelsen, Jonas Åkerlund is the director. It's unrated. It's streaming on Netflix. Heartlock, a romantic drama starring Alexander Dryman and Leslie Ann Brandt. John Kaufman makes his feature directorial debut and co-wrote the screenplay with Chris Cummings. Christy, what'd you think of Heartlock?
It is okay. It is a solid kind of slow burn prison drama. It covers a lot of territory we have seen many times, many places before, but it's done pretty well for a low budget kind of first film without really any known actors at all. So Alexander Dryman plays this young man who is sent to this Heartlock prison institute, and it's institution rather, and it's in the town where he grew up, and he is there for a series of robberies. The girlfriend he pulled the robberies off with has abandoned him. He is there, and he quickly figures out how to insinuate himself with the guy who is really the enforcer at the prison, is played by Eric Leray Harvey, a very charismatic performance from him. He's the kind of guy who can get a phone and get drugs, and he has a pet cat in his prison cell. But he also figures out a way to sweet talk and then increasingly, you know, legitimately flirt with guard played by Leslie Ann Brandt, who is kind of like a young Halle Berry. And he, you know, increasingly falls in love with her as she falls in love with him. But he's also using her to help him sneak out. And so it's stuff we have seen before, but it's done pretty well. It's okay.
Heartlock is unrated. John Kaufman, the director and co-screenwriter. It's at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. Unacceptable Loss is a mystery thriller starring Tika Sumpter, Jamie Lee Curtis, Ben Tavassoli. It's written and directed by Joe Chappelle. Peter, what'd you think of unacceptable loss?
It's unacceptable, Larry. It's just, all of it. No, I mean, it's not a very good movie. Tika Sumpter is, this former policy advisor, security advisor to the president, who was in charge of ginning the evidence. 150,000 people, Syrians, were nuked. That supposedly was, going to solve the war on terror. Jamie Lee Curtis at the time was the vice president. And now, as the movie begins, she's the president. So presumably that nuking worked to her advantage in the polls. But now Libby wants to tell all. But she doesn't have a cell phone. She doesn't have a computer. She's writing a memoir longhand. And she sleeps with a pistol. She knows five languages. There's a guy who's stalking her, and we figure out that it's more than just the usual. He has some political involvement, and it's all very muddled and murky and not particularly interesting or well-directed. The one exception is Jamie Lee Curtis as the president, sheathed in bright white. She would make a great president. I mean, she's supposed to be the villain, but she's so much more engaging than anybody else in the movie. And the movie's such a malarkey anyway that you kind of go with her and you wish she was in it even more. Between this and Halloween, she's back.
Yeah, yeah, which is great to see.
Yeah.
An acceptable loss is at Lemley's Monica Film Center. It's rated R. Tika Sumpter starring Joe Chappelle, the writer-director. Dead Aunt, an adventure comedy starring Tom Arnold, Sean Astin, and Jake Busey, Ron Carlson, the writer-director. Christy.
This movie is terrible, but not even in a fun way. At the top of the show, we discussed Serenity, which is terrible, insane, but fun. This is just shoddy and cheap and never funny. It is about this bad 80s hair metal band called Sonic Grave, and they are getting a shot playing at Coachella, or so they think. And they are in their ramshackle trailer headed through the desert, and they make the mistake of stopping by this one little fruit stand where a Native American has some peyote, and all of a sudden they get attacked by ants. And the ants get bigger and bigger and bigger until eventually it becomes a horror movie, and the ants try to destroy them, and then they fight back. It feels very improvised. It's profane in ways that are lame and cheap. Like, it just feels like people were making things up on the fly as they went along to try to be shocking.
Making up on the ants.
Yeah.
it's so lame. But it does feature exploding ant heads eventually.
Oh, good.
The ants explode.
Dead Aunt is the name of
the name, right?
The action adventure comedy, written and directed by Ron Carlson. The film is unrated. It's at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. I mean, it's hard when you're talking about a comedic movie about a rock group. Spinal Tap just is unmatched, right? There's really nothing at that level.
We should all just have stopped after Spinal Tap. That is the gold standard.
It is the gold standard.
It took it to
11.
Yeah, it
took it to 11. I wanted to mention before we break that Robert Redford just announced he came out for the opening news conference of the Sundance Film Festival. And as you might know, he said last year that The Old Man and the Gun would be his final on-screen performance, that the 82-year-old Redford was retiring from acting. And that, of course, film he starred in along with Sissy Spacek. But he said at the news conference at Sundance that he would no longer in future years be coming out, addressing the press and the audience. He wouldn't be introducing films, and that it was time for him to... Yeah, at Sundance, yeah. That he would stop doing that. Now, Peter, I don't know if you're going next week. You used to go every year, though.
Yep.
And he was a big presence at the festival.
I'm not there this year. He was sort of the grand poobah who showed up and kind of ruled the roost, either explicitly or implicitly. I don't know what offhand is behind that. I know that when he announced that he was retiring from acting in Toronto, he got besieged with questions about that and not about the Old Man and the Gun movie that he was there to promote. And he said that in retrospect he regretted saying anything because all the press was about his retirement and not about the movie. This seems to be a separate issue. So, maybe he's just decided to, you know, enjoy life a bit more. He's certainly very active still as a, you know, as a honcho, as a producer. You know, I think he owns half of Park City. I always thought that if the
Which
Sundance,
is worth a lot more now after Sundance.
Exactly. I mean, I always thought if Redford had been a surfer instead of a skier, we would have had the Maui Sundance Film Festival instead of the, you know, a Donner Party with movies that Sundance is.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm always skeptical. Any actor or director who says she or he is retiring,
well, yeah.
because you're only one great role away. Well, maybe I'll do one more thing,
right.
or you know,
right.
one unless there's you know severe intervening health issues that would keep someone
right.
from doing it, which there's no indication in this case.
No, no. I mean, and like I mentioned when we were talking earlier, Michael Caine, you know, about 10 years ago said that he was retiring from acting and didn't. You know, even
Thankfully.
Jimmy Cagney came back. The only one I think who stuck to it really was well was Garth. And Cary Grant.
Yeah, so true. We'll continue. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Christy Lemire, Peter Rayner with us. We'll be back very shortly. Great to have you with us on Film Week. Larry Mantle joined by critics Christy Lemire and Peter Rayner. Coming up on Sunday, February 17th at the Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, it's the 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. Our critics will be on stage. We'll see clips of the Best Picture nominees and have members of the audience able to ask questions of our critics. Always terrific. I love the questions that we get from audience members because you're going to be in a sea of film lovers, people who love Film Week and are deeply devoted to films. Last year, sold out at the Ace. So we want you to get your tickets now. Visit kpcc.org/in-person to get your tickets. But, of course, there are many more categories of nominations for the Oscars than we're able to take up in our special Film Week event. So we're going to take up two of the categories that we will not be talking about on February 17th during this next segment of Film Week. The Best Foreign Language nominees are Capernaum, as well as Cold War, Never Look Away, Roma, and Shoplifters. Let's start with the Lebanese drama Capernaum. The film is directed by Nadine Labaki, who co-wrote the screenplay. Christy, you want to start us on Capernaum?
Sure. It is my least favorite of the five nominees in this category, and I feel like this category is incomplete without the inclusion of Burning.
Mm-hmm.
Burning should be in here and is not. And so I sort of feel like it's all null and void. Chuck it all out the window. But
wasn't
we got
that the L.A. Film Critics number two film was Burning, wasn't it?
Burning and Shoplifters were both our foreign language picks. Roma was our top film of the year. Was Burning our number two, Peter? Can't remember. Anyway, it's all up there.
It was up there.
There's a lot of love for it. But Capernaum is relentlessly bleak. And it's got some powerful individual moments, but it just feels kind of one note hammering you with the sadness.
I liked it a bit more than that. I think it's a really streetwise, powerful movie in many ways with an amazing performance by this 12-year-old Zain al-Rafia, who is in the movie for most of the film and really has to scurry to survive and make a living and take care of this baby in the process.
The film is Capernaum, and it is in theaters right now. It's rated R, Oscar-nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. You can see it at Lemley's Glendale Cinema, as well as their music hall, their Playhouse, and Monica Film Center locations. Cold War, a Polish romantic drama. This has gotten much love from critics, directed and co-written by Paweł Pawlikowski. What did you think of it, Peter?
I liked the first half of it quite a bit. Pawlikowski did Ida a few years ago, which won the Oscar, and this is his second black and white movie in his native Poland. He spent much of his career growing up in the West. It's a mixed bag because I think once the character in the film defects and the romance between these two tempestuous couples keep going back and forth across countries and times, and it becomes rather clogged with you know, blips of powerful but not entirely sufficient scenes between them. And you get to feel that, you know, particularly Joanna Kulig, I think, is a great actress in this film. And it's one of the best performances I've seen during the year. She sort of looks a bit like Jennifer Lawrence. And there's a little bit of Jean Moreau from Jules and Jim in there, and also kind of a film noir vamp.
I love this movie. It is stunning. It is at the same time compact yet epic. And Pavel Pavlikowski also got a surprise Best Director nomination.
Yeah.
And the film got a cinematography nomination. Joanna Kulig is a total star. It's a big showy role for her. I love this movie so much.
Cold War is the film. It's rated R. It's in selected theaters right now. Never Look Away is a German film. Again, Best Foreign Language nominee. We're talking about all five of them. Tom Schilling and Sebastian Koch star in the film, which is written and directed by Florian Henkel von Dommersmark. You want to start on this one?
Sure thing, yeah. So Florian Henkel von Dommersmark won the foreign language Oscar about a decade ago for The Lives of Others. And here he is also exploring Germany, in East Germany and West Germany. And it takes place over a long period of time. The film is 3 hours long. It's quite epic, quite sprawling, a very old-fashioned, very beautifully made film. But kind of traditional in a lot of ways, and not my favorite of the bunch either.
Yeah, it's a very straightforward, traditional, conventional movie, overlong, not entirely satisfying emotionally or even on a political level. It's based loosely on the career of the painter Gerhard Richter, although he's not named as such in the film.
It's interesting that there's so many previous winners that are included in this the slate of film. So it sort of comes with known figures behind them.
Sure, sure.
Never Look Away, German film, chosen as nominee for Best Foreign Language Film by the Oscars. It's rated R. It's playing in selected Lemley theaters. Roma, of course, from director Alfonso Cuarón, also nominated in the Best Picture category. We don't need to spend a lot of time on it because we've spoken so much about writer-director Cuarón's film, which is streaming on Netflix, also with the New Art and select Lemley theaters. But Peter, quick thought on Roma in this category. Is it possible that it hurts it in the Best Picture category?
It's quite possible. It's also possible that it could win Foreign Film and Best Picture. You know, there's a lot of unprecedented stuff going on with the Oscars this year. My guess is that voters will either decide that, you know, Roma is not Best Picture, really, so we're going to throw all our eggs into the foreign language category. But there's really no way to tell. There have been a lot of strange votes this year. The Mr. Rogers documentary was not nominated. One of the reigning theories is that everybody thought it would be, so they voted for something else.
Favorites,
right? It's
yeah.
like what happened with the Putney Swope plot,
But yeah, but of course it's the documentary branch of the Academy, which is known for kind of going its own way.
Yeah, it's putting it charitably.
Yeah,
yeah.
Christy, what do you think about Roma being in the two categories?
What's interesting with Roma here, though, is it's up against Cold War. And both are extremely personal, exquisitely crafted black and white masterpieces.
And both directors are nominated for Best Director.
They are. And both come from the director's personal lives. Both were inspired by their youth. Like Cold War is about the director's parents. Roma is about Cuarón's time as a child in Mexico City in the 1970s. So I wonder do those two cancel one another out in that regard? I mean, Roma's a masterpiece. And if you can see it on a screen, go see it on a screen.
Yeah.
Roma, again, streaming on Netflix in selected theaters, rated R. And finally, in the foreign language Oscar nomination category, Shoplifters from Japan, writer-director Hirokazu Koreeda, the film starring Lily Franke, rated R. Christy?
Shoplifters is just subtly devastating. It's so beautiful. It's so lovely in its small moments in both its joys and its heartbreaks. It is this slice of life of this family, quote-unquote family, of people living in poverty and sort of stealing day by day just to get by. And the capacity for generosity that they increasingly find that they are capable of, and just the unexpected lovely connections that they make with each other. It's so quietly beautiful. Yeah, it's great.
And a lot to ponder in this film. I mean, it just leaves you with sort of so many questions you can come away with and ask yourself about, the moral dilemmas that are expressed.
Yeah, and a lot of people have said, is this a documentary or a docudrama, and no, it's a scripted, dramatic, acted film, but it's based on something that happens all the time in Japan. It's you know, taken from the headlines, as it were. I know Larry always mentioned what we would like to see nominated in this category.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in addition to echoing Christie's Burning, there was a marvelous movie called What Will People Say, a sort of Norwegian-Pakistani film by a first-time woman director, which was absolutely extraordinary. It was one of the best films I saw all year. It came and went. Few people saw it, even among critics. And if the Kino is the releasing company, and you really should check it out, because it's just a marvelous film that really deserved better.
The title again?
What Will People Say?
What Will People Say? We were just talking about Shoplifters, five foreign language nominees for the Oscar, Shoplifters from Japan, written and directed by Hirokazu Kureta. It's rated R and in selected theaters. We have more to talk about on Film Week. Again, as we preview our Film Week Oscar show at the Theater at Ace Hotel coming up next month. Next, we'll talk about the cinematography category. Back in a minute. Coming up February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. It's our 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview with our film critics on stage. We'll watch on the huge screen at the Ace Hotel Theater the Oscar nominees, see clips from the best pictures. We look forward to that. And those images are always so beautiful on the big screen. We're going to talk about the cinematography category momentarily. But to get your tickets for the event, visit kpecc.org/in-person. Joined on Film Week by critics Peter Rayner and Christy Lemire. Let's talk about the best cinematography category, and where we have some repeats of the foreign language films that we were just talking about, including Roma, of course. Alfonso Cuarón, he shot the film himself, right?
He did.
Yeah.
Exquisite black and white. It's so beautiful. I mean, from the very first shot, you know you are in the hands of a master, and which we knew anyway with Alfonso Cuarón. It's in black and white, as is another nominee.
The very first shot is dog pooping.
Which you don't know at first.
Right.
No.
It's subtle. Elegant. The cleaning.
It's subtle. Right.
You made the point, though, Peter, if I recall, that it's almost self-consciously arty in some places. And there were times with the very artistic pans and things like that, I felt myself sort of noticing the showiness of the cinematography.
Right. Yeah, I did feel sort of abstracted from parts of this film because of the way it was shot, you know, the slow, long tracks. Also, the way he shoots most of it in medium shot, so that you don't often really see a lot of close-ups for a long time. You don't really know what anybody looks like. I found it a little too... The artifice in this film, I think, was a little bit distracting for me.
I found the way it was shot to be totally germane to the story he was trying to tell, right, and the way this family is evolving as this Cleo, the nanny in the middle of it, as her life is evolving as well. It made sense to me.
Emmanuel Lubezki is his normal cinematographer, and he was unavailable at the end to shoot this. Chivo, he's called. He's won the Oscar several times. So Cuarón ended up shooting it himself. He's also screenplay, directing, and cinematography, he's all been nominated for.
He could win five Oscars that night, theoretically.
Yeah.
Wow. If only he would have acted in his
film. Well,
since
the little boy
the story,
is right.
Right. That's his stand-in. Roma, of course, rated R. It's in selected theaters, streaming on Netflix. The Favorite from director Yorgos Lanthimos, Deborah Davis, Tony McNamara co-wrote the screenplay, but the cinematographer for Robbie Ryan is who we're talking about, Oscar nominated here. Peter?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of The Favorite. I mean, it's not one of my favorite movies. So I do think the best thing about it, aside from some of the performances, is the cinematography and the production design, which really lights up the whole set piece. It's kind of like a wacko Barry Lyndon in some ways, this movie, which is also incredibly well shot by the late John Alcott. So, you know, I think you can certainly sit back and luxuriate in the way this movie looks. The other aspects of it, I won't get into.
But what do you think of Robbie Ryan's cinematography, Christy?
Well, The Favorite is my favorite movie of the year. So I would love to see it win as many categories as it can. What I love about the way it's shot is that it looks like a very traditional, very staid period piece. And then over and over again, it breaks away from your expectations of how a film like this is going to be shot, with the long tracking shots, with the fisheye lenses. It's so bracingly alive, and it moves in a way that is so exciting and puts you on edge. So I would love to see this win.
Well, what he tries to do is, you know, you make a period film, but you don't make it look like a period film.
The Favorite, Robbie Ryan, nominated for Best Cinematographer. We're talking about that category. Also nominated, Maddie Libatique of A Star Is Born. Christy.
A Star Is Born is very pretty, and it really puts you in the middle of these big concert scenes, which are so important as far as establishing what that relationship is like between Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper's characters. You feel like you're in the middle of it in big, glossy, shiny ways. It's not going to win, but I'm a big fan of Matthew Libatique in general. He shoots a lot of Spike Lee's films.
Yeah, especially the, as you say, the concert scenes. The opening sequence, the musical number that starts out, is such a whiz-bang piece of everything that it kind of, you know, it's not exactly a letdown afterwards, but it's a really bang-pow way to open a movie. Beautifully shot.
A Star Is Born, again, nominated for Best Cinematography. Maddie Libatique. Cold War, that we talked about last segment, as a Best Foreign Language nominee. Here, Lukasz Zal, the cinematographer who's nominated in this category. Peter, Cold War cinematography.
Yeah, it's again, as with Ida, it's a very, you know, beautifully controlled, black and white. It's great to see black and white movies. You know, I mean, it was such an art, and I'm never quite understanding why it's gone away. I understand for commercial reasons, but a lot of black and white films that have come out have done very well commercially.
The Artist, Best
Picture.
And Manhattan, of course, just gorgeous.
I mean, always, you know, you go back to Last Picture Show, there's a lot of films that really could benefit from it.
And it's shot in Academy ratio.
Which is?
It's boxier. For those of you listening at home, it's more like a box than a widescreen image. But the black and white here is really evocative of a time and place. But there's also such a sparseness and a spare nature to it that you really feel like you are there with them. It's an intimacy that the black and white helps create.
Lukasz Zal, Oscar nominated for Best Cinematography for Pavel Pavlikovsky's film Cold War. And our guest last week on Film Week, talking about the best shot films of all time, himself, Oscar-nominated cinematographer Caleb Deschanel, nominated again for Never Look Away, the German film. Christy, your thoughts on Caleb's work here?
It's very beautiful in a very traditional kind of historical epic way. There are some shots at night. There's a bluish tinge to some of the shots at night that is very melancholy and kind of gorgeous. I like it. I don't think it's going to win, but it's a beautiful film.
I believe this is the first foreign language film that Deschanel has shot in his long career. He's been nominated for the Oscar 5 times. He should have won for Black Stallion, no question, for Right Stuff.
Speaking of gorgeous
you
films.
Know, I mean, he's a great cinematographer who's had an amazing career.
So is there a film here, Peter, you mentioned your one in foreign language you thought was a gross omission. What about in this category?
Well, Burning, I think, is remarkably well shot, and I think
South Korean film.
I don't see the kind of egregious gaps here that I did in some of the other categories. Cinematography, as a rule, is a very strong category in movies, as with acting, too. I mean, it's very rare to see a movie now that's badly shot, it seems.
Although we discussed a few of them earlier on the show today. It is January.
Dead Ant.
The cinematographer, the director, though?
Yeah.
It's hard to know.
Well, everyone's and also, you know, involved. You have all, everything is, you know, film is rarely shown, is rarely used now. It's all digital.
I would also say Burning is an omission here, but everything here is unimpeachable. They all belong.
All right. So Burning's cinematographer you would have liked to have seen nominated. All right. My thanks to our Film Week critics this week, Christy Lemire and Peter Rayner. I'm Larry Mantle, inviting you to join us as we're going to be with you at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A., on Sunday afternoon, February 17th, our 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. You can get your tickets now at kpcc.org/in-person. From all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend. We sure hope to see you at the theater at Ace Hotel. We'll be back with you next week with all the brand new movies to be reviewed. Have a great day.